Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 30.
Hey everybody, today's show is all about the Shinkansen, also known as the bullet train. I talked to Mr. Christopher Hood about his book covering the Japanese high-speed rail system. Minasan, konnichiwa. ようこそ東京ポッドキャストへ。今日も新しいエピソードを紹介します。How's that? Now that I'm back in Japan, I have restarted my Japanese lessons. I have a fascinating new teacher. She's actually an actress here in Japan. She's been in a few movies. I won't say which ones because she wants to keep her privacy. But my goal...is to produce a full episode of Tokyo Podcast in Japanese by the end of the year. Now, might be a very short show, but we'll see what happens with my Japanese lessons. I will try to put more Japanese into my show. Anyways, this week was Golden Week here in Japan, and it's one of the biggest holidays in Japan, and everybody hops on the trains and heads out of the city back to their hometowns. So I thought it would be interesting to talk to Mr. Christopher Hood, who wrote a book recently called Shinkansen, From Bullet Train to Symbol of Modern Japan. And his book is all about the history of the Shinkansen and how it was developed and how it helped Japan develop. I think... You know, the whole world knows about the Shinkansen, also called the bullet train, but I think not very many people understand what makes it work so well and what the impact of the Shinkansen has been, not only on Japan, but on high-speed train service around the world. So I'm going to be talking to Christopher about his book a little bit later on in the show. The big news in Japan this week is that for the first time since 1970, Japan is without nuclear power. They shut off their last remaining nuclear reactor this week, and this of course comes after the disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, which caused massive problems for Japan last year. And since that disaster, the public support for nuclear power in Japan has plummeted. And a recent report I read showed that 80% of the people polled in Japan are against Japan using nuclear fuel. Now, the government has reacted to this strong public opinion by shutting down all the nuclear power plants and claiming that they're going to do maintenance checks on them. But when and if these power plants will be restarted are up for some intense debate right now in Japan. The general public are obviously, you know, not in favor of restarting these plants, scared by the lackluster response of the government to the Fukushima disaster. And I imagine, you know, untrusting of TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, to be forthcoming about the extent of the damage and radiation that came out of the Fukushima plant. So I think many people here are not too trusting of the government or TEPCO to restart these nuclear power plants, even though the government is claiming that they're safe. Of course, the nuclear energy companies are naturally against this, claiming that if they don't turn these plants back on and Japan moves away from nuclear power, it will cause massive power outages and hurt economic growth. Not something that the Japanese government wants to consider, considering that they've had 20 years of economic stagnation. So both sides are kind of debating right now about what should happen. Nuclear power produces about 30% of the electricity here in Japan. And now that the power plants have been shut off, Japan is turning to burning fossil fuels such as natural gas, oil, and coal to make up the difference. Now this, of course, goes against the agreements that Japan signed in the Kyoto Protocol to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So they've traded nuclear power for greenhouse gas emissions. So what's Japan to do? Well, I guess public support is certainly against, you know, Japan restarting these nuclear power plants. And there's been a big trend away from burning fossil fuels here in Japan. I see electric bicycles and electric cars are very popular here, and they're promoted as these eco-friendly transport. But I think many people are not considering where the electricity is coming from to power those electric bikes and electric toilet seats and electric everything else in this country. One option that I think Japan would probably hate to look at is what China is doing. China has recently started building thorium-based molten salt nuclear reactors, which they claim is safer than the uranium-based boiling water reactors that are used here in Japan. And Chinese officials claim that one of the reasons why thorium is much safer than uranium is that for the nuclear reaction to occur, thorium must be bombarded with neutrons constantly. And so in the case of an emergency, the neutron beam can be simply shut off, and there is not enough neutrons left to continue the nuclear process. There's no risk of a chain reaction leading to an explosion like we saw at Fukushima. There's also no need for complex electrical water pumps that could get damaged, which is, I think, what caused the big problem at Fukushima, is that the water pumps were damaged, so they couldn't bring the water in to cool the reactor. But when you have a thorium-based reactor, there's no need for anything like that because thorium operates at atmospheric temperature, so there's no risk of a hydrogen explosion or a radiation leak. Now, this is what China is claiming. Now, of course, anything China says can't be fully believed, as they are notorious for having very relaxed environmental laws, all in the name of profit. This is a country, don't forget, that can't even make gyoza without killing people. So, you know, the thought of China making nuclear power plants is a little bit scary. However, the fact remains that, you know, in the next 20 years, 2 to 3 billion people will start living a more modern lifestyle. You know, they will start buying cars, TVs, computers, etc. And the energy requirements to meet that consumer demand is going to be huge. Now, China obviously recognizes this, and they have plans to build dozens of nuclear power plants across the country to meet this growing demand for energy and consumer goods. And if this strategy pays off, if this turns out to be a safe form of nuclear power, it could be huge for China. By then, I imagine China would have figured out how to make something of decent quality, and they may stop purchasing Japanese or American goods. I mean, they're copying them now. Eventually, you think they get it right. So what's going to happen to the future when Japan is moving away from nuclear power and yet China is moving towards nuclear power? It'd be very interesting to see kind of which strategy pays off. Obviously, here in Japan, the public is against restarting these nuclear power plants, and rightfully so. I imagine these nuclear power plants are quite old, and they're probably not the safest option. But it'll be very interesting to see if that opinion is still as strong this summer during the heat of Japanese summer, when everyone is boiling hot in their little tiny apartments, and the thought of going through a summer without air conditioning or rolling blackouts. And also the concern about the manufacturing sector. If the manufacturing sector slows down due to shortages of electricity, how will that affect the very fragile Japanese economy? So big debate right now going on in Japan about what should happen with these nuclear power plants. Should they start? Should they not start? You know, wind energy, solar, all that kind of stuff only contributes about 10% of electricity to the grid. So they're not really that reliable yet. Will Japan have to look towards China for their, you know, electric energy needs in the future? I know they already buy a lot of rare earth metals from China, and that's a big cause of concern. So I can't imagine that Japan wants to, you know, rely on China even more going forward. But I think definitely an interesting point in Japan's energy needs right now, and the decisions that they'll make right now, I think will have repercussions for this country for a long time in the future. Japan is well known to have one of the most advanced rail networks in the world, and one of the most iconic images of modern Japan is that of the gleaming white bullet train passing in front of Mount Fuji. This network of high-speed trains, known in Japan as the Shinkansen, has come to define Japanese technology with their efficiency, cleanliness, and unblemished safety record. Despite the success of the Shinkansen, though, not much is known about why it works so well and the impact that it has had on Japan and the high-speed rail around the world. My guest today is Mr. Christopher Hood, who is the director of Cardiff Japanese Studies Center at Cardiff University and is the author of the book Shinkansen, From Bullet Train to Symbol of Modern Japan. And he joins us today to talk about the Shinkansen. Welcome to the show, Christopher.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Now, everyone has seen that image of the bullet train or the Shinkansen whizzing around Japan. And it's such a common photo. And many people have commented and written articles about, you know, how efficient the bullet train is. But what I'm kind of curious about is to go back a little bit and kind of talk about how the Shinkansen came to be.
Sure. Okay. The history of the Shinkansen actually goes way, way back. I mean, obviously, there's an awareness, I think, about a lot of people that it opened in time for the Tokyo Olympics in 1964. And obviously, it takes time to build. So there's probably an understanding that it sort of started in the 1950s, something like that. Actually, we're talking 20 years in advance of that. It goes back to the wartime when Japan was expanding into East Asia. And obviously, Tokyo was ending up more and more distant from the sort of the other ends of the Japanese empire as it's expanding. And there was a belief that at that time, with aviation still being relatively slow and limited in capacity, that what was needed was a means to get people from Tokyo over to the Asian mainland as quickly as possible. The state of the railways at the time, narrow gauge, steam trains and so on, very basic. And there's a thought, well, actually what we need is a standard gauge or a broader gauge railway line getting all the way down to Shimonoseki and then by some means or other over to South Korea. There was various different ideas about what would happen there and beyond. And so the original Shinkansen plan, the idea, the word, everything stems from the 1930s, and construction work actually started. They built some of the tunnels, they'd started designing some of the trains and so on as well for it. And, of course, as the war went against Japan, the project has to be halted. But, interestingly, if you look at the newspapers from the time when it's announced in the 1950s that the resurrection of the Shinkansen plan will happen, in the background, when the photograph is being taken of the very first sort of announcement, everything, they are standing in front of one of the tunnels which had already been constructed and would now go on to be used by the current Shinkansen. It's one which you would go through today, going from Tokyo down to Osaka.
Well, that's pretty amazing that way back in the 1930s, they had such an ambitious project to build the train line.
It's incredible, but what's very interesting is that it's the generational thing as well. One of the people who was involved in putting this plan together was by the name of Shima, and it was then another Shima, his son, who actually brought forward the design of the train in the 1960s as well. So there's been kind of in the family links with the Shinkansen, but when they were planning the original Shinkansen, although the designers were told to build it as a steam train, actually, some of them already started thinking, we're going to lose this war. What we need to be doing is already starting to think about what will happen after the war and started putting their mind towards trying to design the first high-speed electric train. I mean, they were really pioneering guys. And it was just by chance all of this actually came together after the war when various other people joined a team from different parts of the military, in fact, and brought their expertise together. And it all just sort of nicely fitted together. And the result was the modern-day Shinkansen.
During the initial planning stages of the 1930s, was there any thought given to other technologies besides steam?
Not really. Although electricity was obviously now starting to be used in trains in those days, there was a concern that electricity was much more vulnerable to attack from American planes, that once the electricity pylons or a power station, whatever has been taken out, effectively then you've got 550 kilometers of railway track which can't be used. Whereas with a steam train, the train itself is the only thing which has its own power, so that's one concern taken away. If the line gets hit, obviously you need to do a repair, but it can be localized in that one area. So during the wartime, steam was the only consideration.
Wow. That's pretty amazing to think that even way back then, they were already planning for what would happen after the war.
And the other fascinating thing from a sort of an English language point of view is the linguistic side. I mean, in the introduction, you mentioned the term bullet train. This is the name we associate with Japan. I mean, Japan has got such a history now with high-speed railways. I've heard other trains around the world also being referred to as bullet train. It's become synonymous, but does anybody actually stop to think where this word comes from? I mean, if you think about it, maybe it's just a certain degree of logic that it's the shape of some of the trains, it goes as fast as a bullet, whatever. Actually, it appears as though, again, it goes all the way back to the 1930s, when they were designing this train, they called it Dangan Resha, which literally means bullet train. And it was in the 1950s when they brought the Shinkansen back, they actually used a completely different term. They were referring to it as the Yume no Chotoku, the super expressive dreams. Eventually, of course, the trains end up being called Shinkansen, but that literally means new trunk line. It doesn't mean anything to do with a train. But in English, we actually readopted the term Dangan Resha, the translation. It got picked up in an English language newspaper, it seems, in the 1950s, 1960s, and kind of just went from there.
I didn't know that. So the word Shinkansen, I originally thought that the word Shinkansen was the Japanese translation of bullet train.
Now, Shinkansen literally means shin is new, kan is main or trunk, and sen is line. So we're actually calling the train new railway line. It's kind of ironic, but it's just the way it evolved over time. And in France, of course, they have two different words, one for the train, one for the railway line, to sort of distinguish between the two, which is a high-speed train, which is a high-speed railway line. We essentially do the same thing in English, but in Japanese, for whatever bizarre reasons, Shinkansen has now become to mean both, even though strictly speaking, it should just be the railway line.
Right. Wow, is that ever fascinating? I didn't realize that. The iconic image that I always associate is that the O series train. What's the start of that train? Where did that design come from? Because it must have looked dramatically different than, you know, a steam powered train.
Sure. I mean, if you look around the world, there were some trains starting to have these rounded fronts and so on here and there. There was even some designs in Japan which were starting to move in that direction. But it was actually one of the team of designers brought into the Shinkansen project. He'd been working on aircraft during the war, and he very much went for this rounded shape. He realized, obviously, it's got very good aerodynamic properties. There was a feeling that would help it with sort of pushing through the air and gaining speed and so on. And he, at one point, it seems, insisted that it should have this rounded design, partly because he knew it would look attractive. And he said the train has to look attractive as well. He would not be happy in signing off the design unless it was good to look at. So they went for this rounded design, and of course it has got very airplane-like features. I mean, it almost looks like a Boeing 747 or a Dakota or something like that. The irony, of course, is that this is a train. It's not an airplane, and trains and planes are meant to do two different things. Planes are meant to go up. Trains need to stay down. And so if you look at the original Zero Series Shinkansen, you can see there's a little skirting down the bottom of the train. It's like a little bit of blue skirt at the front. This serves two purposes. One, if there's any stones or anything like that on the track, it will help push them out of the way, potentially snow, anything like that as well. It gets rid of obstacles. But it's also to make sure not too much air is actually passing underneath the train to start trying to lift it up in the way that an aeroplane would lift up. And if you look at, of course, all the designs of Shinkansen, particularly since the 1990s, they haven't gone for this very rounded design, because in the end it's turned out that this design actually doesn't work very well for train aerodynamics, and it increases potentially the amount of noise made by trains when they enter and exit tunnels, of which, of course, there are a lot in Japan.
Really? So what's the design that they move towards?
They've gone very much more towards, I mean, many of the trains have, I mean, there was the very iconic 500 series, which is gradually being retired now, which was actually designed by a German designer. That was a very long, pointed design, but many of them have got almost like a duckbill design to it. It's not particularly attractive, at least from the front. It's not so bad if you see it from the side, but that helps to sort of allow the air to flow over the top and down the side of the train, and that's much more effective for the trains operating at high speeds, and particularly in reducing the amount of noise given off by the trains as they enter and exit tunnels. They almost create like a little sonic boom, which obviously isn't great for people who live near the tunnels.
Right, right. When they were designing the O series, did they have wind tunnel technology? Like, were they aware of the impact that the wind was going to have on such a high-speed train?
I don't think they had particular, I mean, they didn't have the sort of wind tunnel technology that we would be familiar with today. And I mean, Japan's got, I think it's used to be the largest and it's certainly the quietest wind tunnel in the world. So I mean, they've got lots of technology now. It was a lot more limited in those days. Their concerns primarily at that time were actually just making sure this train stayed on the track and did not derail. I mean, we are talking about a time when trains just did not do these sort of speeds. I mean, the British with the steam train Mallard had got up to 126 miles an hour, so around about 200 kilometers an hour. But that was pretty much a one-off, and there was nothing else approach it. So the Japanese were really taking trains to a completely different level. And there was concern that trains at high speeds, basically they would start wobbling too much from side to side and so on. And so this was really where a lot of the concerns was focusing, rather than on whether this thing was going to be creating lots of noise as it entered and exit tunnels. That was very much a secondary thing. And of course, back in the 1950s, 60s, when the Shinkansen was first being built, there wasn't the same population levels. I mean, if you see the photographs of Shin Yokohama Station when the Shinkansen opened, it's basically a station. You're looking at it and thinking, why did they build this station here? There's nobody there. It's just like paddy fields. There's one or two houses and that's it. Whereas now you go past Shin Yokohama Station and it's like huge skyscrapers, apartments. You've got the former World Cup final stadium nearby. I mean, it's so developed. But Japan wasn't like that when this line was initially being developed. So they didn't have to worry about the sort of the environmental impact in quite the same way as you would have to worry about it today.
Yeah, I guess it's amazing to hear this because it just goes to show how far ahead that they were thinking about things.
I mean, the impact of the Shinkansen is huge. I mean, you've got to remember that this is happening at a time just as the aviation world is really starting to find its feet and take off without being too corny. And also the automobile industry is increasing in size rapidly. A lot of countries are starting to say, no, motorways, freeways, aviation, that's the way forward. Railway, that's going to be confined to sort of the 19th century. This is Victorian technology. This is history. Now, the Japanese were saying, no. There's still a place for railways. And, of course, the success of the Shinkansen was so great that not only did Japan continue to expand its network, which it's still doing today, other countries then copied it. First the French, then the Germans, and now, 47 years on, the British have now also woken up and thought, actually, yeah, maybe we could do with having a high-speed railway line too.
Yeah, it's ironic that that's come full circle. I know even in America, which is, you know, the land of the car, there's a lot of talk about why America doesn't have a high-speed rail line compared to Europe or to Asia.
Absolutely. I think there are many countries which need it, and each country has its own special set of circumstances, and there is much the world, different countries can learn from Japan, learn from the Shinkansen, but they need to look at different aspects of it. They can't just say, oh yeah, that's great, let's copy it, because there are different lines, there are different companies involved, and the networks serve different things. So everybody knows the iconic line from Tokyo down to Osaka, going past Mount Fuji and so on, but you can't copy the Tokaido Shinkansen into any old country. Most countries do not have a capital of 12 million at one end, with another huge city of 3 million at another end, with lots of other big cities in between. That's just not repeated in many situations. But if you look at the situation which JR East faces going north from Tokyo, or maybe even now these days JR Kyushu, with its line going through more rural areas, maybe there are elements that can be learned there, because these trains are operated in slightly different ways. The design of the trains, the design of the lines, the stations, there are little tweaks here and there. So there are things which countries can learn, but each country's got its own special set of circumstances. And when we look at the United States, one of the things that's always baffled me historically when there's been talk about developing high-speed railways is this apparent desire to link the East Coast and the West Coast. And it's just like the Shinkansen could not do that. Even in Japan, if Japan was as big as the United States, you would probably not have a single Shinkansen line going across the whole country. It doesn't compete with aviation on those sort of distances. It's better at competing over distances of 500 to 700 kilometers and less. So having a high-speed railway line in the Northeast Corridor in the States, to me, makes sense. Florida, maybe. California, fine. But trying to connect those three just strikes me as being nonsensical.
Right, right. As they were starting to expand the rail network, you know, after the war in the 50s and 60s, did it change how they developed cities?
In many respects, it did. It's very interesting here, though. We see differences over time. I mean, the Shinkansen was very much at one stage promoted as a means to bring the Japanese islands together, sort of this great linking force. And, of course, this is something that very much gets associated with former Prime Minister Tanaka during the 1970s and his desire to have the line going off to Niigata. And the idea that by having a high-speed railway line, say, to Niigata, people could develop new businesses in Niigata, still be able to get down to other companies in Tokyo, people from Tokyo could visit Niigata and so on. And the data from the 60s, 70s and going into the 80s appear to support this, that actually, yes, there was regional sort of generation going on. And cities which were bypassed on the Shinkansen line saw their population go down, saw the number of businesses go down as they were moving into sort of more larger cities nearby. As time has gone on, we actually start to realize that there is a negative side to this, that actually the Shinkansen may be accelerating depopulation of rural areas. So if we take Kyushu now, what we may see over the years going forward is if you look at the stations which used to be on the main line going down to Kagoshima but no longer have a Shinkansen line, these towns and villages will probably essentially get wiped off the map in time because people are actually now moving to Kagoshima or moving to Kumamoto. And even the cities which have a Shinkansen station, they're starting to see depopulation as well because people are saying, well, actually, I can go and live in a bigger city, which is more convenient, and I can go and pop home and see the parents or grandparents at a weekend or at holidays. And we've seen this on the Hokuriku line, also known as the Nagano Shinkansen, where cities like Ueda, which is just one stop away from Tokyo, initially it did well out of the Shinkansen, but now it actually seems to be losing out because it has a Shinkansen station, because people are saying, well, actually, why don't I just go and live and work in Tokyo, or go and live and work in Nagano, and I can just pop on the Shinkansen when it suits me to go and go home. But there's nothing to go home to, because all the shops are closing down and all the facilities. And so the Shinkansen has a negative aspect as well, it seems.
Will that be accelerated with the talk of that maglev Shinkansen that's supposed to reduce the time from Tokyo to Osaka to 1 hour?
The maglev, it'd be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I'm very much in favor of the maglev project itself, but it could see further concentration of population in Tokyo, Nagoya, Osaka. My guess is the cities along the route, some of them may do okay in the short term, but there is this Japanese historical pull quite often towards big cities. And as time goes by, we've got to remember the Japanese population is gone into natural decline. Right. So by definition, there's potential for be moving even more people into big cities away from the countryside because the population in the big cities, there may be spare capacity there as time goes by. So we could, I mean, if you roll forward 100 years and you've got all these lovely high-speed railway lines across Japan, you could get to a situation where in between the big cities, you are literally just going through tunnels and going through greenery and there is nothing else out your window because everybody's just moved to the cities,
right,
which
right.
may or may not be a good thing. It depends on where you come from, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Can you go back a little bit, a few decades? One thing I'm very curious about in reading your book was that what was the cultural impact of the success of the Shinkansen on Japan, you know, coming out of the war and starting to build this and going into the economic boom in the 80s, how did the train impact the culture of Japan?
I think it's the timing is significant. I mean, the Shinkansen was very much opened deliberately in time for the Tokyo Olympics in 1964. I mean, it's referred to as the Tokyo Summer Olympics, but these Olympics happened in October. They didn't happen during July or August. I mean, that'd just be unbearable in Tokyo anyway.
Right.
And so it all gets combined as at this single event. And for the Tokyo Olympics, Tokyo very much in inverted commas, there are also events happening down in Osaka as well, deliberately so the press could go on the Shinkansen that had only been open for a few days and be whizzed down to Osaka on this train, which, I mean, speaking to people who are out there working for the BBC, for example, when the train started leaving the station, they started fumbling around looking for a seatbelt because they just thought, wow, we are going so fast. Don't you have seatbelts like you would do on an airplane? They remember being pressed back into the seat in a way which you just wouldn't normally experience on a train. And so this was able to send out a signal to the world that Japan is back. We are on the international scene again. And not only are we back, to some degree, in some areas, you guys may now already be needing to play catch up with us. We've got things that we can teach you. And I think for the Japanese people, it suddenly gave them confidence that here they are, they've just come out of losing the war. There's the devastation of the firebombing of Tokyo, obviously Hiroshima and Nagasaki with the atomic bombs and so on. And now suddenly Japan is back again. And they are the world leaders at something. Not everything, but at something. And if you can be world leaders at something, why not be world leaders at everything else as well? And so from that point, this is where we start to see the exports gradually building up, because Japan has the technology, has the ability and the skills to start developing lots of different areas. And the car industry was very, very domestic-based until the 1960s. Really towards the end of the 1960s, that's when the exports start. Electronics of various different sorts as well. Some of this was just simply because they had to be developed. You couldn't export them before that. But part of it, I think, was just simply the confidence that the Shinkansen Olympics just sent this signal around Japan that, hey, let's just look a little bit more beyond our own islands. We can show the world what we do as well.
That's pretty amazing when you consider that it was only 18 years after the war.
It's an amazing turnaround. Really is an amazing turnaround.
Did the Shinkansen play a role in the economic growth of Japan in regards to being able to move goods from one part of Japan? Like, is it used as a transport of goods, or is it just passengers?
It's just passengers. Originally, there was a plan for there to be a freight Shinkansen train as well. And actually, even today, as you travel towards Osaka from Tokyo, just before you get into the Osaka terminal, you can actually see part of the construction of a bridge which was made, which was going to be leading off to a freight terminal. There were two main reasons, I think, why the freight option in the end was rejected. One, they didn't really want to be running these trains during the daytime. There was concern that they wouldn't be able to operate at the same speeds as the passenger trains, and obviously they didn't want the passenger trains being slowed down. And then secondly, they didn't want these trains operating at night because they shut down the Shinkansen service between midnight and 6 o'clock every day in order, one, to let people who live near the line have a bit of peace and quiet, but also so that maintenance work, if necessary, can be done on a daily basis rather than, as happens in the United Kingdom, we tend to do maintenance on a Sunday or during public holidays and things like this. I mean, the idea that you'd shut down a railway line on a public holiday in Japan is just ridiculous, because that's one day when even more people might be traveling. So they do this maintenance on a daily basis. And so in the end, it gets to a situation where there was just no capacity for the freight trains. And it's only recently the Shinkansen has really been used for like courier services for taking packages and so on in that respect. But the Shinkansen has had an impact on business. Japanese people do a lot more face-to-face business than we see in many other countries. And if we take what's been going on in recent weeks with the new year, it is not unusual for a businessman to jump on the Shinkansen from Osaka, pop up to Tokyo, go to a company and say, thank you for all your custom last year, that was very kind, here's a little gift, thank you very much, goodbye, and they leave. And they've only been there for like 15, 20 minutes or so. But they've used the Shinkansen to do this. Now, I don't think we'd see that too much in Britain or America. We would maybe send a card, send an email, make a phone call. But in Japan, a lot of this happens face-to-face. And so by linking the cities meant that these face-to-face engagements could happen much more easily. And, of course, that then means for the potential for further economic expansion as well.
Right. Wow, is that ever fascinating. Well, you mentioned safety. The Shinkansen obviously has an outstanding safety record. Besides its daily maintenance, what is it that makes it so safe?
There's a variety of factors. First, there's the infrastructure itself. I mean, there are no railway crossings on any of the main Shinkansen lines. So there's never going to be a danger of a car getting stuck at a railway crossing and the train plowing into it. 50% of all railway accidents, although I think it's a bit unfair to call it a railway accident because by definition there's a road involved as well, but 50% of all railway accidents in Japan happen at level crossings. So by getting the level crossings out of where the Shinkansen, it immediately means the train is essentially not having to worry about anything being in its way. You've also got large fences, which will hopefully reduce the number of chances of animals or even people getting in the way as well. So that means on the infrastructural side, less concerns. There's also, they need to put in place things to help protect the train from weather-related things and other environmental issues, such as earthquakes, obviously, in Japan. But it's also the software. It's not just hardware. Hardware is the train, the infrastructure. The software is then the people who drive the train. They're the ones who are trained to such a high standard that they can park on these trains very easily at a station, and they have to park this train within a 15-centimeter window, too far forward, too far back. And all the people who are very obediently lining up, queuing in a particular point because they know where the train are going to stop, suddenly will have to start shuffling around. And the more they're shuffling around, the longer it takes for them to get onto the train. But of course, it does require the people, the customers themselves, to be compliant as well. I mean, if people just queued up in random positions up and down the platform, and also there was no information on the platform as to where each carriage is going to be, clearly the trains would be in stations longer as well. So it's a variety of different things coming from different angles. It's cultural from the Japanese people, that they've got used to being compliant and queuing up at the right place and standing in the line. But it's also the fact that the drivers are well trained and the train itself is well designed and the infrastructure is well designed as well.
I never actually realized that, because I remember the first time I took the Shinkansen down to Kyoto, we were making stops along the way, and I wanted to stop in Nagoya. I remarked to my friend at our first stop, I said, wow, I was surprised how short the stop was. We pulled into the station, all the passengers who were getting off walked over to the doors, the door opens, everyone walks out, and then boom, the door closes, and we were gone again in minutes.
Yeah, it's less than minutes. I mean, at an intermediate station, generally speaking, the stop is 50 seconds, unless you're on one of these services where sometimes a train will allow a faster train to go through. That happens now and again. But if you're on a typical Nozomi service going from Tokyo down to Osaka, then when it stops at Nagoya, you've got a 50-second stop. When it gets to Osaka, it may stop for 2 minutes because there it's about to go onto a different railway network, essentially, and so they have to change driver and crew and so on. But on the intermediate stations, it's 50 seconds. And one of the things I like about the 50 seconds is that if you go back a few years when Michael Johnson was the fastest man in the world, the Shinkansen is 400 meters long. So it meant that if he got off the back of the train just as it stopped in the station, and he ran as fast as he could, if he went at his world record pace, as he got to the front door, it would be about to be closing.
Wow. Yeah, and I also thought, too, if you're sleeping on this thing and you missed your stop, because the train travels so quickly,
You could be a long way from home.
You could be a long way before you realize, wait a minute.
And that does happen, of course.
I'll bet. You mentioned the drivers. Are the drivers actually driving the train, or is it all controlled by software?
No, it's been driven by the trains. I mean, if you go on a typical underground train these days, they're actually much more automated than the Shinkansen is. With the Shinkansen, there is a computer system there monitoring what's going on, checking that it's been operated safely. If it goes outside or is about to go outside certain safety parameters, the computer can kick in and take control, essentially. I mean, the modern system of the Shinkansen's going from Tokyo to Osaka, let's use that example, is that it knows how far down the line the closest train is, and it is monitoring that. And it will tell this train the maximum speed you're allowed to go up to is 270 kilometers an hour. Now, if the driver's doing 260, the computer just sits there saying, you're fine, don't worry. But the second the driver tries to go to 270 or 271, it will automatically kick in the brakes to make sure that it doesn't do that speed. So it's automatic in that sense. But the driver is the one who's completely in control. And when it comes into the station, the alarm will go off to say, you're coming into a station. I expect you to be doing 30 kilometers an hour. Halfway down the platform, it say, and now I'm expecting you to stop. And the driver has to essentially press an override button to say, no, I'm in control now. I'm going to stop it at just the right point. And so he slows it down, or she slows it down. And there's a little X towards the end of the platform, which they have to line up with a mark just about over their left-hand shoulder on the window of the cab. And they have to line that up almost exactly. As I said earlier, they've got about a 15-centimeter window one way or the other to stop this train. And if you've ever stood on a Shinkansen platform as they're coming in, you'll realize these trains are plowing into the platforms at quite some speed. It's not sort of they drift along very slowly and eke to a halt. They really do seem to have this down to an art form of stopping just at the right point.
Yeah, that is remarkable. Even on the local trains, I always enjoy actually standing inside at either the front or the back to see the operators and the drivers inside at the precision that they use to get these things, you know, doors open and closed and going again. It is just phenomenal.
It's phenomenal, and they go through a lot of training. I mean, I've been to the JR East Training Center, and there they have both a real train where you can practice trying to stop the train at an imaginary platform, station platform. And then they got computer simulations, both a conventional train and a Shinkansen as well. And they will go through hours of this training. I mean, it's almost at times like playing on a flight simulator type thing. And it very much looks like the flight simulators that pilots learn on for a jumbos and so on. And they go through this, but they go through it not just in terms of real conditions. They go through it in the way that a pilot probably would be on an airline, where imagine this happens, how would you deal with a situation? They can put that into the computer. When they're using the real one outside, and I actually had the opportunity to experience this myself, while a normal train has six levels of braking, they say you can only use levels one and two, which is very soft braking, to try and stop this train at exactly the right point. And that's to try and replicate the conditions of stopping when it's very wet, when there's leaves on the line, just when there's a brake failure due to some technical problem and so on. And so they hone these skills and they learn to judge how to use the brakes and so on in a particular way, so that when it comes to them working on very busy railway lines where there really isn't much room for error, they don't make the errors.
Wow. Is the biggest safety threat the earthquakes?
Probably, yes.
And what happens if the train is going along and there's a large earthquake? How quickly can they stop it?
Right. They have a system which detects earthquakes. All earthquakes give off both primary and secondary waves. Now, the primary wave comes out very quickly from the point of origin of the earthquake, but doesn't actually create any damage itself. The shaking which we associate with earthquakes is created by the secondary wave. Now, the further away you are from the event, of course, the bigger the gap between the primary wave and the secondary wave. The detectors are there to pick up the primary wave. The second that's picked up, if it's in an area near railway lines and so on, they will tell the trains, this is for conventional lines as well as for the Shinkansen, shut down. Just hit the brakes, get yourself stopped as quickly as possible. And hopefully by the time the secondary wave, the destructive wave, hits, the train has either stopped or is in the process of slowing down. In reality, if it's near land in particular, the gap between the primary wave and the secondary wave is likely to be at best around about 30 seconds. It takes over, I think it's just over 2 minutes to top a Shinkansen from top speed. So it's still going to be going relatively quickly, but the slower it's going, obviously, the better the chance that this train will not topple over. And I mean, there was one time where a Shinkansen did derail due to a Shinkansen. Nothing happened with the March 11, 2011 earthquake, but a few years ago, there was an earthquake and a Shinkansen derailed. Why did it derail? It was practically over the epicenter of the earthquake. So the time difference between the primary wave and the secondary wave was literally just a couple of seconds. So there was no real time for the driver to do anything. But this train derailed, stayed upright, and not a single person was injured, which again, although there was a certain degree of luck involved in the way the train and the line was designed in that particular area, you got to say that does give a very big thumbs up to the safety record of the Shinkansen.
Can they tell if the rails are not straight?
Not remotely, as far as I'm aware. They can't tell exactly in that way. I mean, if there's huge damage, they can, because there's actually a cable that runs along next to the line, which is used for sending signals to and from the train. This is how they monitor where the other trains are and so on. It's not sort of done by radio signal. It's actually a cable by the side. And the control center can contact the driver at any time to sort of say, you need to slow down, there's snow in front and all the rest of it. So they can phone up the driver at any time thanks to this cable. Obviously, if there's very big damage, that cable will get snapped. So they'll be aware something has happened in a particular area. If they have a suspicion, they will send out observers from maintenance crews and from local areas to start walking the line, looking out for it. And then each of the lines has a train for JR Central and West. It's called Dr. Yellow. For JR East, it's called East Eye. And this is a maintenance train. By all accounts, it looks pretty much like a standard Shinkansen, other than the fact it's painted a different color. These trains can operate at normal Shinkansen speeds, so on an ordinary day, you sometimes see them and they'll be charging along at the normal speed, but they have lasers and various other things on board to measure any slight defect in the line. And after there's been an earthquake, it's very standard for these trains to be sent out just to go and do a double check that there's no damage to the line. But they will also rely on humans to go out and make observations to check there's no structural damage to bridges and elevated sections and so on as well.
Wow, that's amazing. It said that the Shinkansen was one of the first successful high-speed rail networks in the world. Has Japan been able to market this technology to other countries?
Not as well as it could have done. And partly, sometimes I think it was bad luck in terms of what was going on with events around the world at the time anyway. Sometimes it's just due to other issues. I mean, there have been many attempts to try and sell the Shinkansen to China, for example, but sometimes China has sort of started referring to the war and bringing up memories of the war to complicate the negotiations, let's say. Right. In the end, China did import certain aspects of Shinkansen technology, but by this stage, China was almost in a position where it could develop its own high-speed trains anyway, so it didn't need the same level of Japanese help. Korea, they had historical issues, let's say, with Japan as well, and so in the end, they went for the French system, which at the time was also cheaper because of exchange rate issues. Taiwan originally was going to go with the French system, but then experienced a huge earthquake, and that gave everybody a wake-up call at a time when also they were having financial problems with the project, and they suddenly thought, hold on, how would the TGV cope with an earthquake? The Japanese can probably cope with an earthquake. Maybe we should talk to the Japanese. And because the Bank of Japan or some other groupings came together and said, actually, yes, we may be able to help fund this as well or underwrite it, suddenly the Japanese option was there. And in the end, the Taiwanese used essentially a Shinkansen system. Other countries around the world, as we were talking about earlier, America, Vietnam, India, are now thinking about high-speed railways, and they are thinking, well, yep, we need to be looking at the Shinkansen system. But the key thing is they can't just look at it as a single system across the whole of Japan. There are these regional differences, so they need to be talking to the different JR companies as well. And the Japanese government, although this is now essentially a private enterprise, I think the Japanese government hasn't done enough really to help explain the Shinkansen system and to help promote it itself. It's taken too much of a backseat, I think, given how keen we have been to promote Japanese business in other areas. I think they could be doing more with the railways.
What do you think is the future for high-speed rail, say in Japan? There's a lot of talk about the maglev technology, but I mean, you're still looking over 10 years out. Do you think that's the direction that will head?
I think the maglev will be used at least between Tokyo and Osaka. I would be surprised if we see the maglev network expand in the same way as the Shinkansen network has. Only in the past few weeks, the green light has been given to essentially complete the main lines now, at least in some areas. So we will be seeing the Hokkaido Shinkansen open up to Hakodate in a few years' time. The green light is now being given to construct the rest of the line up to Sapporo as well. Another branch of Shinkansen going down to Nagasaki from just south of Fukuoka has been given the green light. The Hokuriku Shinkansen, which currently goes to Nagano, is already under construction as far as about Kanazawa. They've given the green light for that to be extended further past Fukui. If that is then extended all the way down to Osaka, as is originally planned, that will really complete the whole network as it was sort of planned in the 1970s. There were other lines planned sort of right at the beginning of the 1970s, but they were put on a back burner after the oil shocks and so on. What will be interesting is to see what happens when these other extensions are completed. Because does then the Ministry of Transport say, well, this is the money we were putting into these sort of projects. We've had this level of budget for X number of years. We're now going to stop using it. Or are they going to say, actually, we still want to spend this on railways somewhere? In which case, what's then going to happen? And so I think the debate in 5-10 years' time is going to be the interesting one as to where that money then goes to, whether the railway people in the ministry say, no, we'll just give up that share, don't worry, you can go and spend it on airports or roads, or whether they're going to start thinking of other railway projects. So I think that's when people really need to start looking to Japan again and seeing what they're planning for the next stage.
It'll be interesting, actually, at that point, because like we talked about earlier, if there is this super high-speed rail network, this maglev network, will that be a cause for cities and small towns getting even smaller? So then then will that maglev kind of make any future rail network development obsolete, you know?
Well, I mean, exactly. I mean, we could get to, you have to remember, of course, there's always going to be a need for conventional railway lines. And in some areas, that is where improvements really need to be made. And right. We have seen this happening in some areas of Tokyo where certain lines have been expanded from just being two tracks up to four tracks and so on, so that some trains can just stop at the main stations and others sort of trickle through, stopping at all stations, because it can be quite slow getting around Tokyo still in some respects, and the Tokyo area. But if we had a maglev network, I mean, roll forward 100 years, I think you would then be down to a situation where you've only got about 20 big cities in Japan and pretty much nothing in between. But people would be saying, how can we then improve the infrastructure within these big cities? How can we make transport around Sapporo, around Tokyo, around Sendai, around Osaka, Nagoya, etc.? How can we improve the transportation at that level? And I think that would be a lot harder to do because there's limited space. And once you're starting to try and build through people's backyard, you've obviously got to relocate people. It can be very expensive. It can be very unsightly as well. And there's an inherent desire to stay above ground for many humans. I don't think we like going on undergrounds too much. And of course, there are so many underground lines already built in these cities that you just can't go that much. You'd have to go down so deep that the time lost in going down deep would completely undermine the project in the first place. So I think that's where the big debate will happen in the next sort of 20 to 30 years or so, is how to improve transportation within the cities themselves.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things that really struck me when I first moved here, because I come from Canada, and I mean, Canada is the same as America. We drive pretty much everywhere. But I remember one of the few times I'd gotten off the metro line here in Tokyo, and I would have to take three or four escalators, you know, long, long escalators to get up to the sidewalk to get outside. And I didn't even realize how far underground I was until I got off and made the climb.
I mean, some of these are incredibly deep now, which at one level is good. I mean, I was in Tokyo in July last year when there was a large earthquake and didn't feel a thing because I was in the underground. And when I came out, people were meeting up with friends, they're saying, oh, did you feel the earthquake? It's like, nope, sorry, I was underground at the time. Because you generally don't feel it so much. You're protected down at that level. Although the concern in Tokyo always is the amount of water that needs to be pumped out and so on. If any of those generators fail, then there's going to be problems in Tokyo. But they are very, very deep sometimes. And when you're having to transfer trains between one underground line to another in Tokyo, it's not just a matter of 2 or 3 minutes. Sometimes you need to allow 15 or 20 minutes for a transfer because some of these stations are actually two separate stations and one of them could be 400 meters underground.
Yeah, it's a remarkable feat of engineering when you think about it, isn't it? To be able to move this many people every single day successfully.
It's amazing, and I don't think people realize just how many people are being moved every day. I mean, the Tokyo to Osaka air route is the third most used air route in the whole world. But on that air route, the Shinkansen is taking 70 to 80% of the market. So that just gives you an idea of just how many people are being moved on that single route. It's absolutely mind-boggling. It really is. And as I said, there's no sign of this changing, despite the chances for people to use telephones, to use video conferencing. The Japanese still do face-to-face business.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic, isn't it? This and especially when you consider the speed of the internet here. You can pick up your iPhone now and visually see and talk to someone on the other side of the country.
Absolutely.
But the culture still persists in going and paying that visit in person.
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow, that's fascinating. Well, if people want to find out more about the Shinkansen, you can check out Mr. Hood's book. It's Shinkansen from Bullet Train to Symbol of Modern Japan, and it's available on Amazon and all bookstores online. I'll also post a link to his website from my website at tokyopodcast.com. Thank you, Christopher. Thanks for coming on the show. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
No problem at all. Thanks, and good to speak to you too, Anthony.
Thanks again to Christopher for coming on the show and giving us an insight into the Shinkansen here in Japan. I myself am a huge train geek, so I find the rail system in Japan absolutely fascinating. If you are interested in finding out more about his book, it's titled Shinkansen from Bullet Train to Symbol of Modern Japan, and you can find a hardcover version in bookstores all over the place, as well as on Amazon and other online publishers. Don't forget to check out my website at tokyopodcast.com. And if you are on Instagram, the popular app for the iPhone, follow me on Instagram because I've just added an Instagram account and I've been taking daily photos of my life in and around Tokyo. And you can find me on Instagram at Tokyo Podcast as well. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.